The following podcast is a part of the Spin Studio Network.
This is Happy Hour with Lucy and Nikki.
A gigantic supermarket with real product on the shelves that had all been rebranded.
Wow. Chanel.
And, you know, there's Rihanna walking around with a supermarket trolley with Cara Delevingne sitting in the baby seat. You know, like
that
they
is
were,
incredible. You know,
cheers, babes. Welcome to Happy Hour with Lucy and Nikki, the real life shit you only discuss over a drink. But before we start, a little disclaimer.
So we are here for a good time and not a long time. So if you are easily offended, then scram.
Scram, scram.
Scramsky.
So today we have the amazing Justine Cullen, who is currently the editor-in-chief of Jones Magazine and previously was the editor-in-chief of Shop Till You Drop and Elle Australia magazines, as well as having worked at all of our cult classic favourite mags growing up.
Think of it, you name it, you know it. Dolly, she's worked at Cosmo, she's worked at Clio, I think, or Girlfriend.
Girlfriend was her first ever job when she was a teenager. I'm like, I was fangirling hard.
Literally. So Nick and I were just absolutely like gobsmacked talking to Justine about her career because before the time of Instagram and influencers, when we were growing up, these were the careers and jobs that, like, you know, we were just so desperate to have. You know, you wanted to be that girl that worked at a magazine and, you know, worked in the fashion cupboards. And
it was like a whole vibe and like a whole, you know, you wanted to be a part of this, like, industry, and it was so fashion-y and like fabulous.
And yeah, for sure. And Justine is like the queen of this kind of amazing industry. But yeah, so Justine, aside from being this kind of magazine guru, has actually just released her very own book called Semi-Gloss, which is a book that covers everything from her life, like marriage, the magazine industry, motherhood, and all the kind of ins and outs. Do you want to read a little bit from the front, Nick?
Yeah, so basically the front, it says, it's a witty, intelligent, razor-sharp ride through life that is truly a delight to read. And that is coming from her friend Zoe Foster Blake, another icon living.
Another magazine icon living. So,
but she's done all of this in her life, and she's also a mother of four, which I just found so inspiring. And she kind of like opens up about being, you know, a little bit more raw about that and saying, you know, it isn't easy to have it all. And just talks about her journey and everything she's done to get her to where she is today.
Yeah. So she's a serious career woman. She's a mother. She's been the editor of like the biggest magazine in Australia. She's written a book. She's been divorced. She's kind of done a lot of things. So we just jump straight in with a great old chat with her. So without further ado, let's bring Justine in. All right. Welcome, Justine.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, we feel very, very honoured.
Oh, it's a joy to be here.
So we start every interview with what is your wildest story?
My wildest story. I mean, having worked in fashion for such a long time, there are so many wild stories. I think, you know, the process of writing the book was really interesting because there were some things that, you know, for legal sake had to maybe be removed and things that we weren't allowed to put in there. One of those, it's mentioned in the book, but not quite the way I'd written it originally. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say this, but was about a cover shoot that we did many years ago with, I probably won't say her name, someone who was on the TV show Glee, who was, you know, generally when you shoot a cover, the celebrities are really, really lovely, you know, because it's their job to be lovely and charming, and it's why they're there. They know that you're writing a story about them. This particular talent was a devil in ways that I cannot even explain. I kicked a shoe at my fashion director and it hit her in the head.
Oh my God.
Was just vile about everyone she met, horrible to all the crew. Didn't let the shots, you know, we couldn't complete any shots because she was sort of just done and would walk off. So there were so many moments where, you know, following that, people would say, oh, what was she like? Was she lovely? And I'd be like, oh. But yeah, I think in terms of sort of, you know, bad behavior or incidents of, you know, those moments of like, oh my God, what are we doing here? Having someone kick a shoe at my fashion director's head was probably right up there.
Literally. Far out. That's like, we were going to actually ask one of our questions further into the interview was definitely going to be, what is the biggest diva moments that you've ever witnessed? So surely that's got to take the cake.
That was right up there. I mean, generally, I think the people that you shoot for fashion magazines, they're really happy to be there. It's this sort of symbiotic relationship where they're doing us a favor, we're doing them a favor. It all kind of works together. So generally, people are really nice. And I will say the fashion industry doesn't have a lot of divas. You know, that's kind of a little bit old school. It doesn't really happen that much anymore. So I think I've been very lucky in terms of all of the wonderful people that I've worked with over the years, and I haven't seen too much really horrendous behavior, but that's definitely a big one.
Yeah, fully.
That's a shame to hear. That's not very gleeful at all, is it?
Well, just to give everyone at home a little bit of a nutshell, what is, I think, is it a synopsis of your book?
Yeah. Well, the book, you know, I guess I turned 40 a few years ago now, and I had originally intended to write a book of pop culture essays, sort of based like first person stories, but very much based on my musings on things that were happening in the world. But I happened to have just had a baby, and I'd started a new job after sort of 25 years doing the same job. And so I sort of looked into myself a little bit more than I expected to, and it ended up being very much a story about sort of growing up and growing older and my life through the lens of the fashion industry and having worked in magazines all these years, and then transitioning into being a mother and a wife and all the kind of mistakes that I made along the way, which sounds very serious, but I've tried to make it very funny.
No, I can't wait to read it. It sounds like it's so, so interesting. So
I love it. Serious but upbeat.
Exactly. Well, my husband works in comedy, and I keep saying whenever anyone says they've read it, I'm like, which bits did you laugh in? Stop thinking you're a comedian. You're not a comedian. Well, I thought I was funny.
Well, it appeals to us because we both grew up as kind of like I studied journalism and marketing at uni. Nick studied marketing, and we kind of grew up in the era of like Cosmo magazine, and like we both had Dolly Diaries when we were growing up. And so my
dream. Dolly Diaries.
Remember Dolly Diaries? So I literally always grew up before, you know, before the time of Instagram, thinking that I was going to become the editor of Cosmo magazine. So you are literally like my idol, essentially.
You know, I think there's a whole generation or a couple of generations of women who grew up feeling like, you know, that world was so larger than life, and it was so important. And of course, you know, nowadays the women who once dreamed of being magazine editors want to be Instagram live stars. So it's a very kind of it's a modern progression. And probably obviously, you know, there were only maybe five or six editors of magazines ever at one time. So there's a lot more scope now, and I quite like that it's become a lot more democratic in that way. But I was the same. I grew up just hero worshipping the editors of the time. I couldn't get enough of Dolly and Cleo and Cosmo. So it was very much sort of a dream come true for me to break into the fashion industry or into magazines in general. Like for me, it was just all about wanting to write editors' letters, which is essentially what the book is. It's like 70,000 words full of editors' letters.
I love that. We kind of skipped ahead a bit. But tell if you wanted to give our listeners a rundown of like your career and like your progression, how you first got into the industry, because, yeah, you worked for Elle magazine for a long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was the founding editor of Elle in Australia when it relaunched here. But before that, I'd started originally at Girlfriend magazine straight out of high school.
Oh, so I was the Girlfriend.
Best. When I worked on Girlfriend magazine. And I was a teenager at Girlfriend in the early 90s. So it was like just the glory days of grunge, and everything was so cool, and it was a very fun place to work. And I think, you know, working in teen mags is really fascinating too, because teenagers are really smart and they're really passionate about things, and you can't underestimate their intelligence because they'll call you out on it straight away. So it's a wonderful training ground for people who want to work in magazines.
Wow.
And then I moved to London, and I worked on a BBC magazine there, which was another incredible part of my publishing education, where I sort of moved into beauty. So I was a beauty editor then for a really long time, way too long actually, too many summer body specials and know, all of those things that you pull out in beauty, more fragrant stories than I know how to count. But what being in beauty does is give you a really incredible crash course in the business side of publishing, because in those days, most advertisers came from the world of beauty.
Yeah.
So that was very much how the magazine stayed afloat. and beauty editors spend a lot of time schmoozing the marketing managers and the DMs. Mm. And so it was, at the time, it was really considered editor school. So a lot of the editors, Paula Joy, Mia Friedman, they'd all been beauty editors in their day. And then I went to Dolly and I was the deputy editor there. And then I became the editor of Shop Till You Drop magazine, which is another one that is pretty insane how many people still to this day come up to me to tell me that Shop Till You Drop was their favorite magazine. It was a lot of fun. We sort of flew under the radar a little bit at ACP, which was the company that made all the magazines. And we could just do these crazy things. We would do issues where everything had to be Australian or everything had to be under $200. And, you know, we did an issue once where everything had to be online. And this was in 2011. And I had people from the Retailers Association call me to say, you know, you'll never work in this town again. And how dare you do this?
Wow.
Which I think now that everyone just, you know, shopping online is just par for the course, seems really fascinating that it was only 2011 when people were completely freaking out at the idea that we might be encouraging women to do this. And then eventually, of course, moved on to Elle, which was the first magazine I ever interned at and my favourite magazine of all time. So for me, that was very much the dream. It was the only sort of goal that I'd ever had.
Wow. Yeah,
so,
wow.
And that didn't happen.
So you've pretty much put your finger in every pie, you would say.
I mean, it's a fairly limited scope. When I resigned from Elle a couple of years ago and I went to work in custom publishing to work for brand, because for me, I'd sort of seen the writing on the wall for a while. Our budgets were being cut. You know, the industry was rapidly changing. For me, I thought, God, I've had the best of it and I want to get out while I still feel really proud of what we're making.
Yeah.
And I moved into branded, and I think that's sort of very much the future of publishing, where, you know, you're making things, the budgets are there, you're not relying on a reader's whim month to month or copy sales. So, you know, that's sort of been my first shift into a new world at the grand old age of 42.
So just for the, like, because we understand what you mean when you say brand, but just for the listeners at home, do you mind to explain kind of what that means in terms of moving over to like a branded magazine that's owned by a company essentially, or a brand.
By a company. Yeah. So I work for an agency that essentially creates content, and that might take the form of, you know, a digital campaign or a strategic creative campaign, you know, for the season, or a magazine. And we make them for them, you know, for that brand. So for example, I am the editor-in-chief of Jones magazine, which is the David Jones publication, amongst other things. But that is, it's a magazine, it's a fashion magazine. It looks like any other fashion magazine. It has the same tone and it has fashion editorials and all of that sort of thing, but it is essentially funded and using all David Jones brands. So for me, it's, you know, it's a way to kind of adapt to a changing industry while still doing the thing that I love and am good at.
Yeah, that's so cool. Mm. It's so cool that companies like David Jones are still able to put budget into print media, essentially, so that it still kind of,
like, they've kept it alive, essentially, which is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think that that's easy to do in fashion, because in fashion, that relationship that you have with your reader and selling them something has always been there. You know, that's always been the part of it. We used to have lots of research in consumer magazines about how, you know, the readers loved the ads as much as they loved the content, because that's all part of the experience of it. And so in branded content, it doesn't really feel very different. It's just a much more transparent relationship. They know they're buying the David Jones magazine and that all the products in there are from David Jones. And it's just a very kind of, it's a closed loop in terms of, I can show you the product, but you know exactly where you can go and buy it. Mm. So it makes a lot of sense in fashion. And, you know, really it does, you know, it is an amazing thing that we're able to keep, or I guess put new breath into has been a really challenged industry.
Yeah, totally. So what made you, like, at what point in your career did you kind of decide that you really wanted to write this book? Was there a light bulb moment, or is it kind of something that you've always thought, oh, that might be a good idea, or?
No. I mean, like I said, I had originally intended to write a very different book, and it was only in kind of like exploring my own feelings that I was going through to that time. I'd left the only job I'd ever sort of known or wanted to have my entire life. I was really grappling with that loss of identity and this idea that I was no longer Justine from Elle, which was something that everybody understood in a few words. And so it was really about me sort of exploring who I was, and also getting to a point in my life where I had finally, after a couple of mistakes, found the man who was right for me. And, you know, I was in a really happy place, and I was able to get to that point where I could, you know, explore my past and my history and who I was now and how I got there. And I think that that's something that happens to lots of women around my age, where you really come to a place of peace with who you are and where you're going. And, you know, that very much happened to me. You know, I hit a sort of a certain age and I was like, oh my God, I'm sort of halfway through and I'm happy with what's happened for the first part of my life, but am I confident with what's going to happen in the second part? And who do I want to be, and how do I want to get there? And I guess the book was part of exploring that.
Wow. Because you're now a mother of four. It's four children that you have?
Four boys, yes.
Wow.
Wow.
And then you've been married for how many years?
So my husband and I have been married for 3 years. So he's stepfather to three children, and then we have a baby who's two.
Wow. How?
So my children range from 16 to 2.
Oh, wow. So you've had all of that on your plate while also being
a career woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, for me, and I think this happens to lots of, I think it's quite a female thing, that for me having children really sparked a sort of sense of creativity that maybe I didn't have before. I think I always enjoyed being in magazines and I sort of floated through a little bit, and it wasn't until I had children that I became really hungry to do really good work and to make a mark and to feel like I was, I don't know if some of it was just ego and I just wanted to feel like I was still relevant. I think that does happen, and, you know, it's, I don't think that that's uncommon.
Yeah. I always think, like, for myself personally, like, I just turned 30 and I, you know, like, we have our own business and, you know, we're working in it all the time every day, and I'm just sort of like, holy moly, if, like, realistically in the next 5 years I'll probably have kids, and I feel tired already thinking about how the hell to do it.
But I think, and this is again something that women have a tendency to do, is like we're planners and we try to strategize it, and like, when would be a good time to do this, and how can I fit this in, and does this fit in with my greater life plan? Sometimes I think you almost need to be, you know, a bit more male about it and just do it and then work it out later.
Let it happen.
You
know, yeah.
Sometimes the best plans are the ones that you haven't made.
How did you juggle it all? Like from a logistical standpoint, like, because you were obviously working full time, you had three kids for many years, and then now you've got a fourth. Like, how did you like fit it all in the day?
I did it very badly a lot of the time, and that was another reason that I wanted to write this book, was because, you know, I think particularly with social media these days, we are presenting a vision of ourselves that's not real, and you know, I know lots of people talk about that now, but particularly I think when you're working in business or you have a high profile career, there's this expectation that you must have some secret. You must know there's some holy grail that no one else is aware of that you've tapped into, and you can get it right. And people are always asking me about how I handle the juggle. And I really hated that pressure, because I never felt like I really handled the juggle. I was always patching it together in bits and pieces and, you know, pulling my mum in to save the day when I needed to go on a trip. And so, yeah, I don't know that I always did it well, but I got it done. And that was, I think, the most important thing.
I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Well, going back to the magazine kind of portion of your life, I guess you're still in it for sure. But, back in, you know, kind of, I guess the magazine heyday, what were the biggest
glory days?
Yeah. The glory days. What was the biggest kind of pinch me moment for you in your career?
Oh, look, you know, there were so many. I think that in the fashion industry, there are so many fantasies that are just a reality. And, of course, that's countered by the boring parts and, you know, it's not all excitement every day. But, you know, I think, you know, one highlight is there, you know, there were so many moments of travel and going to these incredible places, you know, going to Chanel shows at Paris Fashion Week, or you know sitting front row at some incredible spectacle that you can never even imagine. You know, I was there at the famous Chanel Supermarché show where they turned the Grand Palais into a gigantic supermarket with real product on the shelves that had all been rebranded.
Wow.
Chanel. And you know, there's Rihanna walking around with a supermarket trolley with Cara Delevingne sitting in the baby seat. You know, like
that is incredible.
And you were there for that moment.
Absolutely, yeah. And there, you know, there are some, you know, I've been sent to Morocco for the birthday of a necklace, and you know, there are incredible things that, you know, the visual spectacle of it and the magic of it just kind of can't be denied. I think one of my key amazing moments was getting to visit Coco Chanel's apartment in Paris, which is kept exactly as she had it all those years. It doesn't have a bedroom because she actually slept across the road at the Ritz. But her, you know,
fabulous.
It was just this beautiful series of living rooms where she would entertain, and is so beautifully preserved and really felt like, you know, for any kind of lover of fashion or womanhood, to be honest, just felt like being in some sort of mecca almost. You know, it was almost a spiritual pilgrimage. And I think, like, there are those moments where I think I was just a kid from the suburbs. What am I doing here?
Wow, yeah, that's amazing. And in terms of celebrities, like, you would have obviously met so many people along the way. Who's probably the most outstanding to you?
Oh, goodness. Do you know, I've never been someone who's crazy impressed by celebrity. I'm always, you know, I'm more impressed when somebody's incredibly professional and helps you get the job done. There are many, many wonderful people who I've worked with over the years. I would say that one of the best examples, I talk about this a little in the book, of professionalism ever, was a shoot that we were doing with Elle Macpherson, and it was a cover shoot and her ex-husband was shooting it, who she was married to when she was really, really young. And his name is Gilles Bensimon. He's a very famous French photographer. And he wanted to shoot on Sydney Harbour, but out beyond the heads. And it was a choppy day. And we were all like, oh, yeah, we're fine. You know, we're Australians. We're on boats all the time. And every single one of us just started vomiting our guts
the
entire day. At one point, the skipper had to stop us from vomiting in the bathroom because we were blocking the toilet. So he was like, you all have to just vomit over the side of the boat. And we couldn't do it. But Elle was so incredible. She was also sick, but she would just sort of elegantly lean over the side and then just get back to shooting. You would
see an
inch of it in her face. I couldn't even stand up. I was just giving high fives, like a sort of, you know, a thumbs up from the ground to say, yep, shot looks good. But she was absolutely resilient and incredible. And I think that is the mark of a woman who has been killing it in business and her career for a very long time. She gets the job done.
Yeah.
Literally. That's like true blue Aussie girl behavior.
Totally. Yeah. Nothing's going to stop her from getting
You
done.
Love hearing stories like that because you so often hear stories, and we work with models in our job a lot as well. And just when you have a model on a shoot that has a bad attitude, it is just so disappointing.
It makes it really tough. I shot recently with a very famous model who I won't name, but who we were shooting in the cold. And every time we turned around, you know, she'd be in a wonderfully steamed dress, and then I'd turn around and she'd be asleep under a blanket in the dress, you know, needing to have a rest between every shot.
And
you're just like, oh, look, I understand that it's cold. Believe me, there's nothing in the world that would let – I would never be able to do that job. I think that is – I struggle to get my photo taken at the RTA, you know. But I think that there's a level of, you know, where you've just got to kick in. You've got to make that kind of your resilient spirit come through in those moments and get through the cold.
Exactly. Like, and it takes a team of people, you know. Like, sometimes what you don't realize is, like, one day with one poor team player, that's like thousands of dollars down the drain essentially if you're not, like, you know, or working towards the same goal.
No one has that to throw around anymore. The days of sort of, you know, when I very first started out, you would have weather holds and 3-day shoots to get 8 shots, and now it's like can you get 16 shots for me in one day and maybe some gifts? And, you know, it's a very different story now. The expectations are higher.
That's it. Yeah. And I think as well, people don't realize that how, like, I guess the person at home reading a magazine or even, you know, scrolling Instagram and looking at these shoots, I don't think people understand how much money and effort and time goes into them sometimes.
Yeah, I think the effort is a big thing, and the team of people who are all just absolute experts in their field, just really poring over every detail. And, you know, the pre-planning and the level of thinking that goes into it. I mean, anyone can go and take pictures for a lookbook or, you know, you can make it, it can be an easy thing to do. But, you know, at its very kind of highest level, there's so much deeper level thinking that goes into every story and every composition. And, and you know, they are works of art in many ways.
Totally. I want to know about some of your most memorable magazine covers, because I know you were there for very special ones. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, probably my favourite of all time was the cover that we shot of Nicole Trumfio breastfeeding her baby Zion, which was a really incredible moment that wasn't planned. She was just, we were shooting her with the baby and he needed a feed. She started feeding him standing on set, and our photographer snapped a picture. And then when I saw it in the edit, I kind of took it to my publisher with, like, on my hands and knees being like, we have to run this.
I love that.
And that then, we didn't realize it at the time, but it was the first ever cover of a woman breastfeeding. So that went all around the world and was, you know, one cover of the year and was really successful. We also did a couple of really fun covers, things like we shot the first cover, the first fashion magazine cover on an iPhone.
Oh, that's so cool. Which
really dates us, the iPhone 7. But that was really exciting and really fun. And just, you know, the logistics that go into making sure that, you know, that no other device touched the image at all, that, you know, when you're in magazines, there's so many levels of retouching that goes on, or, you know, people working in layers on the computer. And so, you know, that was a fascinating process. We also did a very fun cover where we shot Gemma Ward, and we shot five covers and then we sliced them in thirds so that you could make a flip cover and you could combine different eye makeup with lip makeup.
Awesome.
And that was really fun. Yeah. And just sort of making sure that she was shot in exactly the same position and had to stay very still for every shot so that it would all match up. You know, I think the wonderful thing about magazines and the thing that's so sad about the fact that they're disappearing very fast is that level of creativity that goes into all of them.
Yeah, and, it's like
how exciting and inspiring that can be.
Literally, like, just even the thought of sitting around brainstorming that campaign where you would, like, with the half a face and, oh, like, that's, I'm a marketing girl. That just gets me a little bit jacked up. I, like, even thinking about that, I'm like, woo!
And that very much came about because my creative director and I were sitting there one day going, like, oh, it feels like it's time for a big cover. Like, you know, on a big cover. And we were looking around and I had just gone to a bookstore and I'd bought a stack of books for one of my children. And one of them was an animal flip, like a flip book where you could make, you know, you put a dinosaur's head on a, you know, a bird's body. And I was like, we could do this. Originally I wanted to do it with outfits and have them shot full length and have it as outfits. And then I realized that was a bit hard. So we moved on to face. But, you know, inspiration can come from the strangest places. And I think that's often when it's the best.
Literally, yeah. Like children's books.
So true. So I just want to go back to how you mentioned the iPhone shoot and how, you know, with magazines especially, there was, you know, in some cases, you know, crazy amounts of retouching. You would have been working in magazines through that whole period of kind of the kind of resistance against retouching and, you know, only using size zero models and all of that kind of stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about that time? Because I feel like that was so, so interesting to kind of watch from afar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was there from the very early days when retouching was considered this great thing and you could do anything with it. And, you know, I've told the story before about being asked to lighten celebrities' skin and things that these days just seem so, you know, they're so horrific. You would never dream of doing anything like that, but was quite commonplace then. And we would even, you know, there were times, there's a time I remember on a different magazine, not one that I was working on, where they would shoot the fashion assistants' bodies in the clothes that they wanted and then just pop a celebrity's head on. So it would be like the fashion assistant's body, Melissa Milano's head or Misha Barton's head or whoever that happened to be. And I mean, it was a little bit crazed. And then thankfully, you know, that movement changed and people started to realize that that was really wrong. And then I think in the later days, what's been so wonderful is the move towards diversity and an understanding from the industry that this is something that the audience really wants, that women really want to see representation in all its forms, and a level of realness that idea of terrifying retouching so that someone looks like, you know, they're a robot is not necessarily what anyone wants to see or isn't what makes anyone feel emotional or connected to the image either. So it's definitely been so interesting to be part of that progression, and I'm really proud that, you know, we're in a place now where people understand that that change needed to happen.
Yeah. Was it a hard thing to manage considering you would have been at the top making some really top level decisions? Was it like, you know, kind of something that was hard to juggle with kind of the things that you'd always known versus what people were asking for, but then, you know, not the whole audience wants a certain thing? Like, I would have found that really difficult, especially
being a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Mm.
I think most editors for a very long time were fighting for inclusion and diversity, even though we probably didn't even realize that, you know, there were no words for it back then, but we always wanted to see a variety in the kinds of people we were shooting. And often it was the people above, so the publishers, you know, we like to think that editors are the last word, but that's not always the case. There's generally a board or a publisher or, you know, someone who's making the decisions or approving the decisions on another level. And I was always quite comfortable going into fight for those, for, you know, the things that I thought were really important. I think at Elle we were the first people to run, you know, which seems crazy now, but the first people to run an Asian cover star. And, you know, I've also talked about there was a lot of resistance to me shooting Rebel Wilson, for example, that everyone was like, you know, bigger girls don't sell or Asian models don't sell. And there's all this mythology around what cover stars would work and who was bankable and who wasn't. I was quite happy to always go in and have those fights, and I won quite a few of them. I also lost a lot of those fights. But I think that we made a lot of progress in the time that I was there.
Mm. Yeah, wow. That
would have been amazing to be a part of so many firsts.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big part of what we wanted to be at Elle. We really felt like we were there, you know, our role within the fashion magazine kind of spectrum was to champion womankind. And for me, it was such an honor to be the editor of a magazine like that at a time when women were really finding their voice and there was the Me Too movement and, you know, feminism was really finding a new space for itself with a new demographic who'd never really identified as feminists before. And that was a really beautiful magazine to be a part of at that time because we could really stand for something, which I think is, you know, it's one thing to talk about beautiful handbags and shoes all the time, but that's not the only thing that most women care about. We can be very layered, and to just think that a woman who loves fashion cares about nothing else, I think is incredibly reductive. So we wanted to represent a lot more than that in terms of our audience.
I used to love like going down to the news agency and getting my little magazine and just reading like that woman, like female, like tone of voice in all the articles and stuff. It's just like, I don't know, gives me a little thrill thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I loved about having such a huge variety. You know, Australians were some of the biggest consumers of magazines in the world. And I think that was part of us sort of, you know, looking outwards all the time and maybe having a little bit of cultural cringe and not feeling like we were really good enough on the world stage. But because of that, our magazines were really, you know, of the highest standard and really stood up to our international competitors. And I think that, you know, one of the saddest things about the lack of magazines on the shelves now is that you don't have that huge variety in a voice. I loved that I could pick up a copy of Elle and I got one tone of voice. And for us, that was always very speakily. I had this rule in the office that with anything that you wrote, I needed you to read it out loud. And if you didn't sound like you were talking to a girlfriend, it couldn't run. Mm. And so, you know, Elle had one voice, Vogue had another when you wanted a different kind of a friend. Cleo had a very different voice to that. So, you know, I loved that there was that variety and you could really find almost your, you know, your magazine person in that way.
Totally. Like you go to the different magazine for that different kind of, you might have your cheekier friend or your literally more sophisticated friend or...
Yeah. And for me as a teenager growing up, just avidly consuming magazines, that was what got me hooked. You know, that Cosmo had felt like this sort of glamorous older sister and Cleo felt like a really fun best friend and Dolly was me. And, you know, that was part of what really made me addicted to it, that I felt like I knew them and I was very engaged with them and very sort of emotionally connected to them for that reason. And part of, I think, of what made Shop really successful was because we were so aware of the fact that it was essentially a catalogue. It was, you know, it was just product and where to buy it. So we really put a lot of humour into it and we put a lot of sort of storytelling into it. And that was what I think a lot of women connected with, that we made it so much more than a catalogue, even though really at its core that's what it was.
Totally.
Even think back to Dolly Doctor. Like
I was going to say, Dolly Doctor.
That was quite literally the most intimate advice I received as a teenager. Like some of the things you'd read. Oh.
It was one of my jobs as the deputy editor of Dolly to go through the Dolly Doctor letter bag. And can I tell you, it was literally a huge Australia Post bag every single week.
Okay, because that's what I've always wanted to know. I'm like, did people send them in or were they written, you know, with like in-house?
There were thousands of them, thousands.
I love that they came in the post.
Yeah. And you know what was so cute? They would come in pink envelopes and handwritten. They'd have hearts all over them and beautiful illustrations. And sometimes they'd be written in the form of a poem. You know, teenagers are so creative and beautiful and they put so much work into it. And look, a huge amount of them were jokes from teenage boys or girls being really clever, but they were pretty easy to tell the difference. But, you know, I do wonder now, like it's scary for me to think that instead of having that really trusted voice. And, you know, the Dolly Doctor role was taken incredibly seriously by the women who were Dolly Doctor over the years. But, you know, now instead of getting that trusted sort of older advice, are they getting it now from Discord or, you know, for like where is it coming from? That scares me a little bit.
I'm not going to lie. I think I learnt what a blowjob was from Dolly Doctor. Word of a lie.
A huge proportion of the Australian population that learnt everything from Dolly Doctor.
Literally. It really was like an iconic part of like growing up, wasn't it?
Oh, totally. I remember because my sister was a lot older than me, so she used to buy a lot of the magazines, well, 4 years older than me. And I remember I'd like kind of be reading Dolly and I'd sort of almost be like half trying to read the Dolly Doctor page really in secret. Like, no one look. I can't be reading about fingering.
I don't know if you remember, but there were two pages. There was Dolly Doctor, which was medical, and there was What Should I Do? And What Should I Do was always my favourite because I always liked the scandal. I wanted to know about how you had a crush on your friend's boyfriend or your
It was
teacher
always the crush.
So good. Ah, this is giving
bring
me all.
Bring it back.
Bring it back. This is giving me literally all the feels. I feel like if someone was to make like a Dolly magazine now, it would absolutely go off.
I mean, the problem is how do you reach that audience now? Because she's not, and this is part of my issue with consumer magazines, even, you know, when I left Elle, you're not in a supermarket most of the time. You're definitely not in a newsagent. So how do you reach her? And, you know, that's why the answer is always going to be digital. It's just what form does that take? And I don't know that anyone's found the answer to that yet, but I hope they do because I think that sense of community that rallied around those magazines was so amazing and a vital part of being a teenager in this country and, you know, and many others.
Totally. Well, what's some advice you would give to young girls kind of wanting to get into the maybe not as much magazine industry but kind of the publishing industry that you're in? Like, I don't know, I still feel like it's a dream for so many girls out there. It's still my dream, even though I'm 30.
I mean, I think the wonderful thing about the direction that the world has gone in is that anyone can create content now, and you can be really, really good at it without necessarily having the backing of a huge magazine or, you know, an international masthead behind you. So I think the trick is to become really good at content and then to just, you know, parlay that into still interning and work experience is the way to break into anything. And learning on the job, I think, is always preferable to any other way of picking up any skills. But, you know, I would just say to start doing it, to start writing. Writing is a muscle and you really have to work at it. I learned that writing the book. It had been a long time since I'd written anything over a 500-word editor's letter. Mm-hmm. So it was a real struggle for me and I hated every minute of writing my book. I can't tell you. It was not fun and it wasn't easy.
How long did it take you to write the book, like from pen to paper?
It's really hard to tell because I've got four children, so I would write in like 20-minute increments and sometimes I would not write for 4 months. I can say that I was 2 years late on the deadline.
Gotcha. Yeah, what was the process in you writing your book as well? Were you kind of approached by a publisher in order to like create your story or...?
Yeah, I had a publisher approach me about a book and then I put together a proposal that they really liked and then I promptly wrote nothing. So I think I gave myself about 6 months before it was due and I had not written a single word. So I got a few extensions and the book changed form many times until it got to a place where, you know, I was comfortable with where it was at and handing it in. But even towards the end, and, you know, I say this not to be self-deprecating, but because I think it's really important because things look easy so much of the time. And, you know, you can look at someone who's done something and you're like, oh, that seems so easy. You know, for me, I wasn't sure what I was doing for a long time. And when I first sent the book off, the manuscript to the publisher, the subject line was, what is the point of this book? Like I really, I wasn't sure. And we worked it out. We worked it out as we went. And, you know, I think that's important to know because things are not always easy and sometimes it's going to be harder than what you imagine. I thought that I would be struck with inspiration and I'd be able to churn a book out. And in the end, you know, I was literally catching minutes here and there, you know, when I was, you know, up at night being an insomniac or early in the morning when I was breastfeeding a new baby. I was just catching minutes, but we got there in the end.
Yeah, congratulations. What a journey.
Huge. Did you ever have moments of like self-doubt when you were writing it, like when it was taking so long? Were you kind of like, oh, do I even want to do this?
I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think, you know, that is a particularly female way to be. Like we all feel like imposters. We all have that sense of like, am I meant to be in the room? I had some wonderful advice. When I first left Elle, I had a wonderful coach who was just kind of helping me transition into going from someone who had one dream for 25 years into someone who kind of needed a new dream for the next 20 and didn't really know what that was. And she was really helpful. And in one of those moments of self-doubt, I'd said to her, I've got this book deal and I just don't want to do it. I haven't got any time and I can't be bothered. And, you know, and she had given me a really quite a harsh, tough love slap on the wrist. And she was just like, just get it done. You've got this wonderful publishing company in Allen and Unwin. And once you hand it in, then they can work with you on what that looks like. And, you know, if it's not right, it doesn't matter because then you're already halfway on your way. And she was so right. It kind of made me just get it done and do it and then be able to progressively hone it until it was, you know, what it ended up as being.
Yeah, wow. That must have been like the day you finally were like, well, I guess it's today, the day that it's like getting released. You must just feel like so much satisfaction
just
and relief.
Like a weight off your shoulders.
I think the relief comes from the fact that people are really enjoying it. I had an article, an extract that ran in the Sunday papers this last weekend, and I've had hundreds of messages from women telling me that they related it was about a divorce and realizing that I was probably married to a wonderful man, but a wonderful man who wasn't for me. And I've had so many messages from women saying that they're in similar situations or it spoke to them in some way or that I'd voiced their feelings that they didn't know how to voice before. And it's easy for me to do because, you know, that's now in hindsight and I'm married to the right man now. But it's so heartwarming and gratifying to be able to speak to women in that way. On a deeper level, you know, I've spent my career talking to women and about women, but to be able to relate on that much more intimate level is really special. And so there's a real relief in that because now I know what the purpose of the book was.
Oh, that's beautiful. And so what's next for you now that you've kind of ticked this massive to-do? What's your next step?
Well, I do have a day job that's very, very busy. So that keeps me busy. I've also written a screenplay and I think that that's probably, you know, an area that I'm really interested in and found a lot easier than writing a book and a lot more pleasant and fun. And yeah, I think it's just exploring new ways of being creative, you know, raising my many hundreds of children.
Literally.
Looking forward to being able to get back on planes again, all of that. So, yeah, it is very much business as usual, although this is a really exciting day.
Yay. I love that you've already just smashed out a cheeky screenplay.
COVID. I feel like, didn't everyone write a screenplay in COVID?
I missed that memo, but hey.
What's it about? It's not like The Devil Wears Prada, is it?
It's not. It's no. It's very different. It's, I won't say too much, but it's much more sort of family focused than necessarily
I love
what
that.
This book is. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Well, speaking of The Devil Wears Prada, I think we've got time for one more question. And I just wanted to know, is The Devil Wears Prada a proper kind of depiction of what working in magazines is like or not at all?
Look, I wouldn't say that it is like a documentary in any way. But there are parts of it that are true. I think the one element of that that's really true is that magazines are not a democracy. There's one person at the head of them, and because everything is subjective, right? So a shoot could be beautiful to you and horrible to someone else, and that's not to say that one person is right or wrong. So there needs to be one person to make the decisions because otherwise nothing would ever be decided, and that is the person upon whom everything lives or dies. You know, all the responsibility falls. If something doesn't sell, it's the editor who gets fired. There's really just one person. So in a sense, as an editor-in-chief, you are God. You are the God of your dominion, as ridiculous as that seems. And so in that sense, it's true, you know, that you are this one person. It's not democratic at all. Saying that, you know, I think in the real world, there are a lot of things said in that movie and things that are done that would have you taken to HR in a red hot minute.
Literally.
So that's not happening.
You weren't throwing your code onto your assistant's desk every morning going, needing you. What did she need?
Yeah, she used to throw the different handbag and coat on the desk every morning, ordering steaks from the restaurant down the road. Like,
I think every editor-in-chief has their eccentricities and I cannot say I didn't have mine. At one point I had a puppy, didn't last long, but I was still alive, sorry, I didn't kill the puppy.
I was going to say,
oh my God, rest in peace.
My assistant used to have to, I would smuggle the dog into the office. It was a huge fine for having an animal in Park Street, but I would smuggle it in this huge Marc Jacobs tote, you know, we're talking the early noughties.
Fabulous.
And she would have to sneak it out for poops in Hyde Park. A couple of times a day. And I think there were moments of that where I was like, this is probably pushing the envelope here.
I love that.
That is a good story. Well, thank you so much, Justine, for giving us your time today. We really appreciate it. And you are an idol of, you know, our youth, like just amazing.
Literally, it's girl boss vibes. We love to hear it.
Thank you. So fun talking to you.
So where can people buy your book?
Everywhere good books are sold.
Love that.
Audio book for people who don't like to read. So it's everywhere out today.
Amazing.
Yay.
We cannot wait to read it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This podcast is part of the Spin Studio Network. To stay up to date with us, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast, leave us a review, and follow us on Instagram @we_the_wild_ones. Cheers, babes.